Omaha Steaks Black Friday deals landed early. We're talking 50% off site-wide and an extra 20% off select favorites, including incredible deals on USDA-certified tender Omaha Steaks. These are the deals you've been waiting for all year. And when you shop OmahaSteaks.com today, you'll get an additional $35 off with code BLACKFRIDAY at checkout. And don't miss exclusive limited-time savings on uniquely curated packages, delicious favorites, and so much more. But you'd better hurry, because these deals won't last, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Don't wait. Shop the early Black Friday sale now at OmahaSteaks.com to save 50% site-wide and an extra 20% off select favorites. Plus, get an extra $35 off with code BLACKFRIDAY at checkout. That's OmahaSteaks.com, code BLACKFRIDAY. Terms apply. See site for details.
And thanks for joining me for another Grassroots Marketing on here on CannabisRadio.com. And on this program, we're going to go and talk about an upcoming event that's going to be held July 25th and 26th. This is the International Cannabis Bar Association's Cannabis Law Institute 2024. It'll be held at the Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law in Chicago, Illinois. And as they announce, as the cannabis industry anticipates federal rescheduling, CLI 2024 stands at the forefront, offering timely and critical insights for legal professionals. And here with me is one of the co-chairs of the event and the International Cannabis Bar Association. I'm here with Jessica McElfresh. Thank you for being on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for that summary. That's we're going to be talking a lot about rescheduling at this year's event, as well as some other hot topics such as emerging psychedelics regulation. Perhaps appropriately to this podcast, we're also going to be discussing or have a panel of cannabis press journalists and discussing how to get featured and how those sorts of things work.
With the press journalists, that I want to go ahead and point that out real quick. Who has been offered a chance to go ahead and participate with the Institute and in these particular panels?
For the most part, I will just get the boring part out of the way. For the most part, this is an event by lawyers for lawyers. And while we are the cannabis focusing type, we're still lawyers. So it's just important to be clear about that. We do at times try to offer some dynamic content, particularly on day one of the conference. So for example, that's sort of a day when we're going to be not only discussing rescheduling, including with a panel that's still developing with some former federal officials and employees who hopefully will be able to offer us a bit insight beyond simply the press statement on the topic or the overall summary that's been released thus far. We're also going to be talking about how rescheduling may affect international transactions in the future. And we're going to also have a panel featuring a variety of state regulators talking about state enforcement strategies against permitted and unpermitted operators. I don't think that one is going to focus as much on rescheduling, but honestly, I think hopefully we can get them to talk a bit about how that may, along with some other possible federal law changes that could occur in the next few years, their jobs will probably shift.
I can imagine with the amount of attorneys that come to network at these events, there could always come in with a bit of frustration because of how much difference in regulation there is for various cannabis control boards in each state from what the federal government is allowing to have happen, and just trying to work around things. When you look at it as a whole, you know, obviously there is some positive sentiment right now of the cannabis rescheduling, but I mean, do you feel like there's any less of a burden that's being taken off of attorneys now of what they're able to go and do for clients because of this distinctive change?
Well, the truth is we're going to find out, and I think it also depends on what your practice focuses on. For example, if you've been an attorney who also does a lot of work trying to advise on federal policy on cannabis, you're probably absurdly busy right now. If you have a practice a bit more like mine that focuses on operation, expansion, regulation, and day-to-day business operations in the state of California, it's really more about how this is going to affect our future and plans that we're making day-to-day. But, in terms of frustration, lawyers always have something to say, or just right. Something about the profession that way that I've noticed. And I'd say overall, I'm sure we will hear a variety of perspectives about rescheduling from panelists as well as attendees. I don't think overall those perspectives are markedly different in terms of whether this is positive or negative or more in the middle, and it's more about what you do with it in the future than the overall reaction of everybody in the cannabis industry. I've found the lawyers are just as split up that way.
Amongst the panel that you have for Cannabis Law Institute 2024, various tracks for the 25th and 26th, but in particular, you have sessions that will go ahead and cover tracks of employment, labor, and medical access, what changes next, CTA expansion and ethics, and litigation, and from the state and local side, litigation, hemp, and future laws. What I want to also ask too is, and this is just my own thought, is that when I'm looking at the programming for the show, one of the areas I would love to go and see if that's something that you'd cover at all, if it's somewhere embedded into the programming, is the differentiation for those that are getting licensed, you know, through a conventional licensing program or going through what New York has with a CURD, conditional adult use retail dispensary license, the social equity licensing. And
Right. Obviously
there's issues within various states we've heard of the process of corruption, because we've seen that. You know, in Illinois, there's a lot of issues with the lottery system that's put in place because of who's able to go in and get those particular licenses. And then the other process goes, in New York, we're hearing about that certain social equity licensees, they might pay the licensing fee that they can't get back. And then when they go through the process of trying to go ahead and open up and the various delays or any kind of regulations or things like that, that could hinder or slow down their opening, and they don't have the capital to go ahead and continue to go through, they have to sell their license off to somebody else who could very well be an MSO. Those kind of issues come into play too. Is there anything about that you have where, you know, you're talking to any government leaders or where you're discussing that kind of area of those kind of things where licensing is obviously very detailed and also just very difficult at times?
Yeah. So my main answer to that would be probably at the last several years of CLI, as well as other events that we've done. We also tend to do a day of programming at MJ BizCon every year.
Yeah.
We've had pretty much a panel focusing specifically on social equity program development at every one of those events for several years running. This year, where we've more moved it is the idea that is more of a topic or an aspect of nearly every topic that we discuss. But in terms of the specific questions you were raising about challenges in licensing and the problems with that, I say you're probably going to get your most coverage on sort of license, let's call it fairness or standards or practices. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a whole panel about license litigation actions. And that's going to focus a lot on sort of the issues with the state licensing ones. You mentioned Illinois. We're going to have a litigator on that panel who's done a lot of litigation in Illinois about their programs there. Also some attorneys from California and New York that are going to be discussing how this has played out and what it has looked like at various times. I think, too, we're going to be getting into some of those questions, though, with a more specific focus on a type of license litigation lawsuit in a panel in the rescheduling tract that's going to be discussing dormant commerce clause and how that is sort of affecting license litigation and will affect other things in the future. A lot of programs have been attacked through those ones, as well as ones just with normal residency preference. Also probably going to touch on a lot of that in one of the final panels of the conference, which is going to be entitled Lessons Learned, Adult Use Programs for Future State and Federal Policy. You know, clearly what has worked and what hasn't and what has delayed people and how we could possibly have avoided this. It's honestly something we do think about a lot. And so it will be discussed in that panel.
Now, you mentioned already that rescheduling is going to be kind of a bit of a theme that will cross a lot of different tracks throughout these conferences coming up in July. And one of the areas I noticed, and a couple of different things I think about when it comes to what we've talked about here on Grassroots Marketing and on my companion series, Blunt Business, that we know that there will be medical benefits with rescheduling in terms of access to more product to have more research. So that would be a good help. Do we know that in the financial side, the 280E distinction, the IRS revenue code, will no longer apply to cannabis businesses, but we'll be able to now start really good and doing, they'll be able to again start writing off taxes. And we already know that Ascend Wellness Holdings, we've talked about this, that they were looking to go ahead and go back to the IRS to get 3 years worth of their taxes, you know, audited again so they can go and write off what was being charged to them before. And is there anything else that I'm missing there in amongst the panels that attorneys that will be speaking at the event are looking at also that opens up because of rescheduling, aside from those two areas?
Well, you know, those are definitely two of the biggest ones. You know, I don't think we're going to arrive at definitive answers to a lot of the more detailed questions you offered at this conference, so I'm sure we'll do our best to try.
Sure.
And certainly to summarize them. I think, too, we do have a track that's going to discuss rescheduling, as I mentioned before. But I think on that one, we're going to be discussing what's going to happen, what else is going to change at the federal policy level. You know, what is going to be required next to have a greater criminal justice reform such as that? How will it play out possibly for additional taxation? Mm-hmm. Are we eventually going to look into transactions between cannabis allowing states, and what will that look like? You know, we've been talking in a way about that one for a few years, but we'll be doing it now against the backdrop of rescheduling. We're also going to be having a panel that will be discussing medical cannabis laws and healthcare considerations. That will probably get into how rescheduling will and will not affect not only research, but also day-to-day access to medical cannabis and what that is likely to look like.
Now, also on the afternoon of the 26th, one of the tracks you have, we talk about state and local litigation, hemp and future laws. Mm. Obviously, the very areas, where's one session you had this called D8 and D9 knocking on the door, 5 W's of cannabinoid litigation. And the area of where the hemp bill doesn't really go ahead and give any kind of direction as to the regulation or the processes for how hemp is being derived or how products can be put out. That's why we can see Delta 9, Delta 9, other synthetic cannabinoids being sold on, you know, vape store shelves or even convenience stores for that matter. And there hasn't been much direction to that. And that's been an issue where obviously various states want to go ahead and ban or eliminate those products from being put out. Also areas when it comes to potency for various CBD or THC strains. That's also been going on. You know, what can you tell me about that part in terms of where the attorneys are? Because it's such an open book as to where Delta 8 and Delta 9 is done, where, you know, anything else cannabis related would be dispensary or a medical marijuana treatment center, it's D9 are able to go wherever they want to go.
I would say, honestly, I think that most lawyers, end of the day, regardless of what their client base is, I'd say most of us, end of the day, more favor a world that has not yet appeared. Which is a world where perhaps, regardless of where the cannabinoid is derived from, it is regulated on a more equal playing field. That has, I think, been one of the bigger sources of tension within sort of the broader cannabis industry. I think, too, there are questions about what is the appropriate amount of safety regulation for, I'm just going to say both for the moment, just to make the distinction easier. And what is based on science versus what is not, and what's going to be the most appropriate way to deal with that. But you're certainly correct. I'm sure this panel will discuss where we're going possibly in the future at the federal level with the hemp bill, what may some federal enforcement look like. But it's also going to talk about a trend we've been seeing of litigation in states where essentially a state will say, no, we're going to regulate this. No, you can't do this, or you can't do it that way. And they get hit upside the head with a lawsuit saying, basically, you know, neener, 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 the farm bill says I can do this, and federal law is supreme, which I have to say, as somebody who's been in cannabis law for nearly 15 years, it's a little interesting now to occasionally see the argument of, no, federal law is supreme, when we've basically spent so much of our time developing this industry with the idea that no, there are a variety of powers. The Controlled Substances Act is not total preemption. The states have the right to explore this and set their own laws regarding some of this. It's, you know, I guess everything in life comes full circle.
I want to take a couple of different conservative websites that have reported some news, or at least some areas from the conservative front that have been kind of going up against cannabis. As a recording with you today, there was a story that came out from High Times about how GOP lawmakers in the House of Representatives are removing legislative provisions to protect banks that serve cannabis businesses from a federal funding bill after resistance from fellow Republicans. And the legislation was removed from the Financial Services and General Government bill, providing annual funding for the Treasury Department and federal payments for the District of Columbia and the SEC, as well as other federal agencies. There's that story that just came out. And also some stories about where you have Democrat, you know, senators that are looking to go ahead and reach out for new legislation to get cannabis entrepreneurs aid from the Small Business Administration, and how various states are offering grant money to help bolster up cannabis, you know, as a whole in their states. What can you think about the government intervention here and what's been going on? Because, you know, the government has really not been receptive enough. I mean, again, what the DEA and what HHS is doing right now is a separate thing, but Congress has been at a lockstep. They have been, you know, at a halt doing anything more to help with any kind of legislative relief.
Well, I would say, and I don't really think this is a political statement so much as one of observation, cannabis is far from the only issue where Congress has been unable to move bipartisan legislation forward in recent years. And meanwhile, you have seen representatives from both parties introducing bills or amendments or adjustments that are more statement-oriented. You know, I don't think that the challenges of cannabis legislation in Congress are a product of it being cannabis. I think they're a product of the legislature being dysfunctional right now.
Right, and the thing is that isn't it just changing the laws? Because to go these other, because the part I don't understand. Okay, of course, obviously, with politicians, lawmakers, if they were getting lobbying money to help kind of, you know, entice them or give them momentum to go ahead and go forward with a bill that's already been put in place, that's already been written, that needs to be put up for a vote, then let's just go do that. Instead, okay, if we're not going to go and do that and not do anything, which I expect them to do, instead they're doing other things where, you know, the state governments are trying to help bolster up the economy for each of these, you know, each of these states that have legal adult use for medical cannabis, or they're trying to go and get funding from other agencies to go help, you know, in other ways. It's like, okay, so we're just going to, you know, finding ways to go and fund it in other ways, some backhanded way, instead of just like fixing the law so it's, you know, better meaningable for cannabis businesses to go ahead and survive. Just give us either safe banking or something else, because all these kind of workarounds, they're not working.
Well, let's get clear. I mean, safe banking, for example.
Omaha Steaks Black Friday deals landed early. We're talking 50% off site-wide and an extra 20% off select favorites, including incredible deals on USDA-certified tender Omaha Steaks. These are the deals you've been waiting for all year. And when you shop OmahaSteaks.com today, you'll get an additional $35 off with code BLACKFRIDAY at checkout. And don't miss exclusive limited-time savings on uniquely curated packages, delicious favorites, and so much more. But you'd better hurry, because these deals won't last, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Don't wait. Shop the early Black Friday sale now at OmahaSteaks.com to save 50% site-wide and an extra 20% off select favorites. Plus, get an extra $35 off with code BLACKFRIDAY at checkout. That's OmahaSteaks.com, code BLACKFRIDAY. Terms apply. See site for details.
Would be a nice thing to have.
Sure.
But it would not mandate that every bank out there has to serve cannabis companies. Some may feel more comfortable at that point than they do with the current FinCEN guidelines. Some would not. But again, I'm not saying I don't agree with you or that I would like to see things move forward or at least go to a vote. But for better or for worse, that is the state of Congress in general now.
Yeah.
That's true of even very crucial things such as, I don't know, the bill to fund the entire government. Expecting cannabis issues to somehow magically navigate or move forward within that all by themselves like a self-powered steamboat, I'm not sure that's very realistic.
No, but the thing is, if they're not going to go ahead and work on this, if they're not going to be actively working on this and making a change, then don't look for workarounds. Don't try to look for some other ways to kind of like just, because you can't, you're locked into doing something. the get your other, you know, fellow policymakers, let's go ahead and get a conference together and do something. Because
what do you mean by a workaround that you deem?
Well, because I feel like by trying to go and find money from other avenues, or just taking money, or just, you know, taking taxpayer dollars just to go ahead and insert it somewhere else instead of just changing the law. That's my whole issue about it. I'm not worried about which side of the side does it.
That is, well, there's a whole class of people who can speak more eloquently about this, but
sure,
that is an aspect of how legislation works. You know, packaging one thing in a broader bill and getting it in there that way, that is just simply part of how it works. And I think expecting the cannabis bill all by itself, you know, those bills aren't really moving forward either. Sometimes the workaround or the inclusion or the policy about how money will or will not be spent is the best that's possible at that time.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, there have been chances where you would think that it hopefully would benefit because of the fact that Congress has to always put so many other things added into bills, omnibus spending bills, where, you know, in the NDAA last year, they tried to go and put safe banking in, but it didn't make it through. It's just a matter of, well, here's the bill with, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 pages, and somewhere cannabis might be included in there, but I don't want it that route either. Let's just go and get something that's cleanly put through, but I know that's asking for a lot.
It is. It is. I'm not saying I don't agree, but it is.
It's one of those things I always feel like, you know, what are some of the things that if you're going to have at your conference, the Cannabis Law Institute 2024, again, in Chicago, July 25th and 26th. My thing is I'm thinking about what can you do? What are some of the attorneys saying amongst each other in these sessions because of the fact that, okay, what room can we do more? Because, you know, we are beholden to what laws are in place and what can be changed, because it's one thing to go ahead and just adhere to, but there's not a lot of consistency in some places when it comes from state to state. And then the same thing goes about what products are also not under a current parameter. That's what I'm saying. Where it would be much easier for attorneys if they had a set of rules to work off of and they weren't constantly changing, or they were kind of just mishmashed together.
Well, perhaps that's true, but I would say for the most part, the job of lawyers is to help clients navigate whatever the current situation is. Some lawyers get to work on policy and legislation and trying to change those things. But honestly, most of us are simply in there with clients day to day, trying to help clients navigate new changes. You know, one example of that we're going to be covering at the conference is the Corporate Transparency Act, which formally went into effect back at the beginning of this year. That's not a cannabis-specific law at all, though it is a federal law. And it's designed to counter drug trafficking and money laundering and other things such as that. But we're going to be talking about how businesses of all sorts, but particularly cannabis businesses, are going to comply with that by the end of this year, and what disclosures they're going to need to make around the owners and what they're doing, and whether we should or should not be concerned about that, given the still existing federal illegality of cannabis. So that's one example of something we're trying to deal with and navigate day to day. Speaking of differing state policies, we're also going to have a panel dealing with cannabis labor issues. A number of states have been requiring labor peace agreements. Others do not. We're going to talk about that and some of the litigation around those issues at the panel. Again, we haven't fully achieved consistency, but I'd certainly say that's an emerging issue among many states in terms of a lot of them are doing it. And you know, we already discussed a number of the panels we're going to have that are going to talk about licensed litigation actions and social equity. I think only a fool would say we've achieved a common model there, but we're certainly doing a lot of experimenting on different models, and I'm sure we'll get some sense of what is and is not working right now against our current laws, as well as the increasing challenges to those programs in federal law under the Dormant Commerce Clause, and well, probably some other things in the relatively near future would be my best guess.
Jessica, I want to ask about on July 25th, the first day of the event. There's a couple of different sessions I want to just point out before we wrap things up.
Sure.
One in particular, you have state enforcement against licensed and unpermitted cannabis operators. Obviously, the illicit market has been very much rampant. In some cases, we might see 40 to 50% of all sales coming from illicit market. And when you talk about that, you have where states, how states are, could be, and should be enforcing laws and regulations against unpermitted operators. Talk about that real quick in terms of, you know, what would help open things up for businesses to be able to get them, you know, for licensed businesses to finally go ahead and get more of what they should be getting, and how law enforcement might be able to go and help curb the market much easier.
Well, I just think that your question has certainly summed up the issues we're going to try to discuss in that panel. The idea of that panel, honestly, is to more offer state officials and regulators an opportunity to comment on that rather than, say, the industry itself. You know, we're interested in what they are looking at, what enforcement trends they are seeing, and what approaches they think are going to be coming up more and more. But obviously, I think anybody who simplifies this discussion is not only cheapening the complexity of it, but also the history of cannabis. On one hand, sure, there is a certain challenge when you represent people who have jumped through not only a series of hoops, but then a series of flaming hoops, trying to be open and legal. Most of us within the industry feel overall we are overregulated. And then at the meantime, we have a backdrop of still an existing unpermitted market that's operating with various levels of openness or blatancy, to use a word. That clearly is not a system that can last forever, one against the other. So I think the question really is, how are we going to sort of, if we're going to even the playing field, say by reducing regulation, increasing the number of opportunities to enter into the market, and overall making it possible for the products that consumers buy to be lower priced. Most consumers, when you poll them, they really do want to shop in the legal permitted market and have it tested for a variety of reasons, but price is always a factor for them. So that's clearly, you know, it's a legitimate issue. But if we're going to live in a world where we're not going to do those things, such as reduce regulation, reduce taxation, all things that I firmly believe we should do, well, what can we do other than harsher enforcement? You know, is there some other creative solution that we are missing or that we are not seeing? And is harsh enforcement even going to be effective? These are not easy questions. And, you know, this is another great one where no state has cracked this yet.
No, but I'll tell you, one of the things I keep talking about constantly on the network here is, you know, there just needs to be more of a route to entry for the legacy operators to be able to go ahead and get themselves legitimized, go through whatever programs that are necessary, and build those out more, I think, is really what it's come down to, is if the legacy operators can be pulled off of the illicit market. Get the ones that are obviously nefarious, but those that have been around for a long time that want to be able to go and be part of the legitimate space, let's give them a path to entry so they can make it in and become licensed and become legitimate. I think there's just going to be more programs that goes towards that. As for social equity, you know, I would hope in the various states, I know they talk about where they want to help those that are disenfranchised, that have been, you know, wrongly incarcerated or wrongly, you know, accused, things like that. But there's also the area where not just those that were, you know, that might have been for possession, or right, whatever else might be, I also want the legacy operators to also get more of that to help to curb that market. Because, you know, for some people, I would imagine, if they want illicit, it's not just because it's cheaper, but I also think they just feel like they want to go to somebody they've already gone through for the longest time without extra taxes, things like that. There's got to be some way to work that around. Yeah, but like you said, it's not a very simple process. You're right.
Yeah, there's some of that. But I have to point something out in this discussion that I think has gotten a little lost. Okay. I absolutely agree with you. I think we do need more paths, more openings, more assistance, more opportunity, period, including for legacy operators. But let's be honest, some people who have jumped in and are currently operating in the unpermitted market, these are not all legacy operators or people who simply could not make the transition. Some of these are people who see an economic opportunity and are choosing to seize it. I'm not saying that makes them bad. I think at times we have this discussion where it's this almost this dichotomy of everybody who's doing this as a legacy operator who was left behind, and that's simply not the case on the ground.
So on July 25th as well, you have a panel on psychedelics regulation, walking its own path. I'm fascinated by this because obviously we know that new states have been kind of online, they've been going live with allowing various treatments of psychedelic treatment, whether it's ketamine, or, you know, looking for other areas to go and open for more treatment. Obviously, there's only can be done so much right now in terms of what can be put out there and what kind of plant medicines are available for those out there, for mushrooms and things like that, for psilocybin. Wanted to get your take on that as well. I mean, we know that we've noticed a lot of people in the cannabis industry also go ahead and add psychedelics into their portfolio. What would you say would be the same for attorneys? I know we've seen the same thing go as well. How many of them have gotten themselves involved in the psychedelics, and what are you looking to go and speak on this panel about?
I think on this panel, the goal more is to talk about how sort of are the regulations emerging and changing? What are they possibly trying to do differently or maybe better in some of the state regulation than we've had for cannabis? And honestly, having an honest discussion about some of the ways that psychedelics are different. You know, one, while we've certainly learned there isn't, you know, one plant, there's certainly a lot more there than I think we thought 10 years ago. With psychedelics, you're talking about a wide variety of substances and different ways that they are derived. That's, and just by itself, is going to change their path and their regulation and their discussion. In terms of interest among attorneys, I think a lot are interested, but it is certainly a much newer newer form of regulation. We're seeing this primarily at this point in Oregon and Colorado. And I think that there's just still a lot of debate about what, even when it comes to your state, it will even look like. You know, how much will it really look like cannabis? Or will it be in a more medical environment? Will it more be the consumption of it more heavily regulated? Or is there some world where for certain substances or in certain amounts it'll go that way, or for others it will go slightly differently? We just don't really know yet. But some of that is about the fact that we are talking about a different set of plant medicines here.
Yeah. Let's direct people to the website, incba.org, incba.org, where you can find more about the International Cannabis Bar Association and the upcoming Cannabis Law Institute, July 25th and 26th at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law in Chicago. Please take a minute, Jessica, and talk to our listeners about what they could go and expect. What they, you know, for those that want to learn more about INCBA and for the institute itself, for those attorneys that might want to also make sure they attend this conference coming up.
Well, sure. So the International Cannabis Bar Association is an organization dedicated to promoting excellence in the practice of cannabis law across the United States, Canada, and we have a variety of international members as well. If you're interested in getting into practicing cannabis law, this is definitely a wonderful event to go to, an organization to be involved in. And right now, clearly, the sooner you register for our event, which is somehow next month, eek, I don't know what I'm going to do, please come. But also be aware that right now, many of our tickets for non-members are priced in a way that you will also receive a year's worth of membership in the organization. They'll give you access to our listserv, full access to our directory, our ethics of practice spreadsheet, our hotline for practitioners for ethics issues, and so much more. And you'll also be able to join committees. And ultimately, if you join the CLE committee, for example, you might get to be involved in the planning of next year's CLI.
Fantastic. incba.org. Make sure to go ahead and check out the website and learn more. And if you are an attorney, you need to go and keep your eyes on this. And if you can make it to Chicago coming up in July, make sure to do so. Again, I've been joined with Jessica McElfrisch, who's founder and principal at McElfrisch Law Incorporated and co-founder. Co-conference chair, for the INCBA Cannabis Law Institute. Thank you for being on with us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Omaha Steaks Black Friday deals landed early. We're talking 50% off site-wide and an extra 20% off select favorites, including incredible deals on USDA-certified tender Omaha Steaks. These are the deals you've been waiting for all year. Don't wait. Shop now to save 50% site-wide and an extra 20% off select favorites at omahasteaks.com. Plus, get an extra $35 off with code BLACKFRIDAY at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details.